if you grab one of these ground squirrels up in the mountains here and you stick them in the lab and it just, you keep the temperature warm and constant all of the time, are they just never going to go into hibernation? Or
it's funny that you say that, because that's literally what we're doing right now for our big project with NASA.
Really?
And so we're looking at warm temperature.
I like to have NASA level ideas generally on the fly.
Right? Yeah. Are we?
Yes.
Where are we?
Here.
Why are we here? Not entirely clear. We are misfits thrust into existence by random chance with no hints at all as to how we're supposed to make sense of it all. It's immensely bizarre. Here we are.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Here We Are podcast. Today, I am in Las Vegas. I'm at UNLV talking with Frank Van Brooklyn today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So tell people a little bit of an overview of what you do.
So I'm a professor and I'm the director of the School of Life Sciences. I'm interested in how animals hibernate. I'm really sort of interested in how animals live in what we deem to be really harsh environments. And one of the main mechanisms for dealing with harsh environments is to literally sort of check out, right? Is to go into a metabolic depression, use much less energy, and survive for a period of time.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's all you study, all the action that no one gets to see.
It's really boring, actually. Yeah.
Is it boring? Because to me, well, it's so interesting to think about, because we think about these animals that like when we see them. If you like take a squirrel, for instance, when you ask someone to describe what a squirrel is like, I mean, it's like this scattered, running around, jumpy thing. And
but most of their life, they're actually spent in hibernation, right? I mean, that's the funny part.
Aren't they one of the biggest hibernators kind of out there?
Like a bear is a really big hibernator. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And actually, you know, our definitions of hibernation are ever evolving. Just a few years ago, I would have told you that bears didn't hibernate. I would have said that they denned, because they were big and they didn't have a real big reduction in body temperature. So we thought they were completely different. Now I would put them all on one big giant sort of gradient of hibernation.
Interesting. And there's all the way to, I know years ago I was reading a little bit about torpor, which is that how you pronounce it? Like
torpor.
Kind of torpor.
Yep.
Torpor. I was reading a little, I read science and I don't always get a chance to talk to actual scientists and know how the words are pronounced. Torpor is an interesting, there's like a few species that do, like, what's that about? Where does that fall on?
So it's interesting. Like, there's people out there who think that torpor and, so daily torpor and hibernation are two different things. And what I would do is I would say that they were on a continuum. Hmm. And so we see animals that do like daily torpor. And many of those animals that do daily torpor also do hibernation.
And can you define what torpor is?
Torpor would be the depressed metabolic state. So in hibernation, we think of hibernation as a dynamic process in most mammals where they spend 1 to 3 weeks in torpor. Their body temperatures can be below that of freezing water, right? It's below 0 degrees C. And their oxygen consumption can be 1/100th of normal oxygen consumption. Then every 1 to 3 weeks, they'll spontaneously arouse, bring their body temperature back up to about 37 degrees. And then they'll stay in this inner bout arousal for some 12 to 20 hours and be sort of normal. That's the hibernation season. So when they're down and they have this low body temperature and low oxygen consumption, they're in the state of torpor.
Can you give me an example of some species that like...
Ground squirrels are the best.
Wait.
Right?
Did I misunderstand? You said lower than freezing?
Yeah, minus 2.9 has been found in Arctic ground squirrels, and minus 2 have been found in the animals that we work with.
Wow.
That are actually found just 45 minutes away from Las Vegas.
How in the world is that possible?
So it's interesting. So the person who described this, it had been described years and years ago, and then Brian Barnes found it again, and he got the cover of Cell back in 1989. And he talked about this idea of supercooling. I can take a bottle of water, stick it into my freezer, and it'll be at minus 20 degrees and it'll still be fluid. As soon as I shake it, it freezes up, right? So he was thinking that's what was happening because there is no what we call a hysteresis between the freeze and the thaw point. So if you've ever frozen over your car, it's a nightmare to get it to thaw, right? It takes forever for it to actually re-thaw because you don't have to bring it just up to freezing point. You have to bring it up to like 20 degrees C before it'll actually thaw. So he thought that there needed to be a hysteresis in terms of...
What, can you define that for me?
That's that mismatch between the freeze point and right. the thaw point.
Okay.
And it doesn't seem to be the case. It looks like we can have antifreeze proteins that just simply prevent freezing from occurring.
I bet the Cell magazine people felt pretty foolish about putting them on the cover after
science. Yeah, no, because still people have been subscribing to this. Super cooling is really hard when you have a solution with a lot of variation in it. So like blood has cells in it and has proteins and all kinds of other stuff. It's really, really difficult to envision that actually super cooling. You usually need something that is very, very homogeneous, like straight out water, right? Too many salts and you can't get it to super cool. Has to be pretty clean water in order for it to super cool.
That is hard to wrap my head around. Because there's water in all of the cells and everything of a squirrel, and how is it not?
Well, and that's why we think that it's an antifreeze protein. And what the antifreeze protein does is that in order to get, and the reason why supercooling even works, is that in order to freeze, you need to start it off. You have to have a nucleating event that initiates the freezing point. And what the antifreeze protein does is it grabs hold of all of the ice crystals as they begin to form, and they prevent them from ever really grouping together and occurring. That's why when you take that water out of your freezer and you shake it for a few seconds, it freezes over immediately because you created these little micro bubbles that allowed it to start to nucleate.
That's so interesting. Sorry, did you say that there's squirrels nearby here?
So just 45 minutes away from Las Vegas is a ski resort.
Really?
Yeah.
It's nearly 100 degrees out today. So I'm like,
absolutely. But if we looked out there, you'd actually still see some snow out on Mount Charleston. And so there's a ski resort there, and golden mantle ground squirrels live there.
Really?
Yeah. Crazy.
So you got to go and get bundled up and drive 45 minutes and to go and research them.
I actually grab all my squirrels out of Utah because there's a higher density, but yeah.
Ah, I see. That's fascinating. So in pretty much every species of squirrel hibernates, right?
No, not really. It's really the ground squirrels that are good at it. Tree squirrels, we don't think really hibernate.
Mm.
Now, a lot of this is sort of changing in our view because... a friend of mine is out of Australia, and Fritz Geiser, he was interested in the marsupials that hibernated. So he started to bring animals into the laboratory, and many of the animals didn't hibernate. And then somebody came up with what are called eye buttons, which are these little tiny temperature loggers, and we can put them into animals. Mm. And so he started putting them into the animals, and it turns out that everything hibernated, right? All these animals that he had brought into the lab that never hibernated started hibernating. So hibernation is much more prevalent than we ever thought it was. And it's all the major groups of mammals hibernate.
All the major groups?
Just about, yeah. Crazy one is lagomorphs. Primates, yeah. There's a few good hibernators and daily torpor animals. So like,
wait, which ones?
Like mouse lemurs and dwarf lemurs and slow loris. There's quite a few of these guys.
Well, because there's those, what are those? Are they Japanese? Those the ones that go in hot tubs?
Sure.
That,
yeah,
that
no,
you'll
they
see?
Don't.
And they don't. The ones that you think should be
yeah.
hibernating.
But, you know, there's even, you know, do humans hibernate, right? Hmm. So
I feel like I'm in like a torpor sort of situation.
Back in, I think, 2006, there was a Japanese man who he had gone with his friends and they were climbing a mountain. And he decided to go back alone, and he ended up falling and breaking his leg, and he was stuck out there for 21 days. And when they found him, his body temperature was in the low 70s Fahrenheit. And so we suspect that he actually went into a state of torpor, and that's the reason why he was able to survive this.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's kind of cool.
So there's clearly a lot of environmental triggers going on. Are there, if you grab one of these ground squirrels up in the mountains here and you stick them in the lab and it just, you keep the temperature warm and constant all of the time, are they just never going to go into hibernation? Or
it's funny that you say that, because that's literally what we're doing right now for our big project with NASA.
Really?
And so we're looking at warm temperature.
I like to have NASA level ideas generally on the
good,
fly.
Right? Yeah. No, I mean, so we're very interested in sort of warm temperature hibernation and what that does. And the reason for it is that my lab right now also works on an animal called a tenrec out of Madagascar. And they sort of are changing the way that we see hibernation, because they hibernate at warm temperatures and they can be active at cold temperatures as well. And so they kind of really screwed us all up in terms of how we think mammals work. And it led us to think that, you know, being warm and hibernating is really hard for a ground squirrel. And it turns out that, you know, data so far look like that's the case.
It does look like that's the case, that they'll just stay up and
they'll go into hibernation still,
oh.
But they don't do it well.
I see.
And I see. This is really sort of problematic. NASA would love to hibernate somebody at 20 degrees C, room temperature, right? Mm-hmm. Or a little bit colder than room temperature. Because they expect to have to keep a spacecraft there. And if they could hibernate you at room temperature, they wouldn't have to have any extra equipment, right?
Oh, man. I would pay. That's going to be one of those things, like once NASA develops it, then like that'll be like a luxury thing that you can get for yourself, like a little hibernation. It'll take off and no, especially
I don't know.
There's everyone out there pitching like float tanks and ice baths. Yeah. And there's going to be all sorts of wellness influencers pitching on the.
It's a little rough on animals.
Yeah.
So they wanted to be able to hibernate humans at 20 degrees C, and I went, oh my god, that's the worst temperature you could use. I was like, that is going to be so confusing for an animal. Below 20 degrees, great. And maybe even really high temperatures, okay.
So it's right
but
on that.
But just not 20 degrees. And so far, our data is kind of suggesting that we were right and that this isn't a great temperature.
So go colder.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go colder and maybe we can hibernate?
There was a paper that came out last week and
Person that's going to try that?
Well, this paper was really cool because what they did was they took a mouse and they used ultrasonic waves to activate part of the brain. And when they did that, the mouse cools down and drops its oxygen consumption.
Wow.
So
just no other environmental trigger, just the same. Wow. Okay.
And we've known for a few years now that we could do what was called optogenetics, where we can genetically engineer and modify an animal so that we could activate these neurons with light, right? But these guys figured out a way to just do it with just ultrasound on animals that were completely normal otherwise.
Wow.
And the crazy one was that they were actually even able to do it to a rat. And rats aren't known to go into any kind of torpor. Mice are. And so it's super exciting, and we'll see how it develops.
So it's just flipping on on the net, like what's happening, because I would have thought this was more of like an endocrine process of like a slower hormonal like build up to a hibernation. And
we we know, we're pretty sure that there is a preparatory stage, right? Okay. That animals need to prepare to go into hibernation, and they might need to prepare twice, right?
You would hate to just fall over unexpectedly.
Pretty much, right? And so so it might be a little bit more difficult than what we think, right? We'll have to see.
So let's do some basics before I ask a few questions that are on my mind. What is hibernation for? Like, why did it evolve in the first place?
Great question.
Yeah.
So, you know, hiber was the Latin word for winter. And because science sort of grew up in Europe and North America, people kind of thought of hibernation as simply being overwintering. Well, it turns out that hibernation probably evolved in the tropics. And so my animal, the tenrec from Madagascar, it lives all throughout the island, which, you know, he can live in some cold areas, but...
Wait, what is this? What's a tenrec?
The tenrec is this really, really weird mammal. It's a placental mammal, but it has a whole bunch of ancestral traits. So, for instance, it has a cloaca. It has one opening rather than separate anal and urogenital openings. So instead of having, you know, multiple holes...
I like that.
It's got the single.
It's efficient.
And that's seen in the egg-laying mammals, but not even in the marsupials. And there's a whole bunch of other very ancestral-type traits. But this guy hibernates in Madagascar, where it's warm and hot, or warmer and hotter. And so there's really no need to hibernate in terms of an overwintering. There's food available year-round. But when you think about it, if you're walking around, you're going to get eaten, right? So why bother walking around? Why not just go down and go into a burrow? And when they go into a burrow, it's really cool because we found on YouTube, everyone should search YouTube for your primary data, but we found on YouTube a video showing that these guys hibernated socially. Nobody had known this. And so this hunter pulled out 13 tenrecs from a burrow, and it's about 1 meter, 3 feet or so, into the ground, and they seal it. So imagine going over and going in a group 1 meter below the surface, sealing it up, and taking a dirt nap for 8 months.
You got to like everybody in that squad. I wonder if anyone gets kicked exactly. out first before yeah. that. That's got to be a brutal selection. I mean, I love cuddling, but not willy-nilly with 12 other people at random.
For 8 months, right?
that's fascinating. It's less about like classical survival in the way that we would think about it, and more like, oh, what's the point? Why bother?
So, you know, my view on evolution has dramatically changed. You know, I think of evolution as being what's good enough, not mm-hmm. what any kind of you know, optimization or anything along those lines. It was good enough for you to be able to make it into the next generation. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the tenrecs, the largest litter in the tenrecs that's been found so far is 32. So they have these enormous litters, which tell you that they die all the time.
How many nipples we got?
You got close to that, like
32,
29-ish, usually, something along those lines. And so these guys are constantly just making babies, and very few of them make it, right? So they're getting eaten, or they're dying in hibernation. They're messing up all the time. Mm-hmm. But it's good enough, mm. right? Because when you have that many babies, all you need is one or two of them to make it, and you're good to go.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's just a numbers game.
Yeah,
that's I mean, that's a lot of species out there do that, but that's not mammals usually.
Not in mammals, and in the weirdest thing in the mammals is that the species that I deal with is the biggest of the tenrecs. It can get up to 2 kilograms in size, mm. right? Which is actually a fairly large animal, and we have these little like rice tenrecs that are really small. They only have one or two babies at a time. So they've completely reversed that sort of relationship of number of offspring with this body size. Because usually if you're small, you have lots of babies because everything can eat you. And if you're big, you have very few babies, but not in the case of the Tenrecs. They're really bizarre mammals.
And does it does the parental investment change quite a bit between those two species, whether they're...
Very little is known of the Tenrecs. So, you know, for instance, Steve Goodman and Link Olson say that they have 11 species that are awaiting description. So if you told me there were 11 mammals that needed to be described, I'd be stunned. You tell me that there's 11 in a single family, and it's crazy. And the reason for it is that everyone who goes to Madagascar basically just looks up at lemurs, right? Yeah. If you were going to go to Madagascar and you're a mammalogist, you want to work with a really charismatic lemur, and so you're staring up at lemurs all day, not looking for these Tenrecs in the middle of the night.
That's interesting. How big are they?
So smallest species is only 5 grams, and my guy gets up to about 2 kilograms. So there's quite a bit. There's 34 described species, lots of variation. There's some that look like otters, some that look like shrews, some that look like hedgehogs. There is animals that are fossorial, meaning they live on the ground, some that are arboreal, living in trees. There's even one that's aquatic. Very little is known about it. Lots and lots of variation.
Are there fish that hibernate?
Great question. So there is a paper a few years ago that talked about cod in Antarctica actually going into torpor and kind of going into this like out of its state on the bottom of the ocean. We also know that there's a lot of fish that do estivation. So estivation is this idea that like lungfish, for instance, live in these ponds that when they dry up, they'll burrow into the mud, and then they'll go into a metabolic depression in a little cocoon that they secrete. Some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, secreting a cocoon. That's so cool.
Yeah, we see that in some frogs too.
Well, I guess I ask because I was curious, do we have an idea of when hibernation started evolving?
Well, I would argue that what hibernation is, it's a sort of elaboration of sleep. And we find sleep in just about everything, right? And so put it onto this big continuum of sleep all the way into like a ground squirrel hibernator, and you have that giant continuum that we were talking about.
What gun to your head, though, if someone's like, you need to pick a time where you can get in a time machine, you're going to go back, and everyone's going to agree, now that thing is hibernating. How long ago?
Well, clearly in fishes, we would have estivation. So I'd put it into the hundreds of millions of years ago.
Okay. So it's been around for, that's not that long, really. I guess mammals have been around for not too much longer than that.
No, much, much less than that, right? So.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, when did mammals evolve again? Boy, I haven't done this podcast in so long, I'm forgetting
all
of my... It
gets really, really sort of difficult because what you have is like the modern mammals that we're thinking about, like placental mammals.
Yeah.
So the dogma on DNA time would be about 105 million years ago, but fossil record would say it was more about 65 million years ago at the KT when the asteroid hit and the dinosaurs went out. And so... Prior to that, what you had was you have these mammals that are more or less mammalian-like, right? So you have this problem of well, how much of a mammal are you? And how tight is your body temperature regulation and things like this? And it turns out it's really only in the really modern mammals that we see this really nice, tight body temperature regulation. So it's a very difficult one to get at.
Okay. Well, what about, more of the, obviously, I don't know why I'm trying to get you to commit to arbitrary boundaries.
Ooh, I don't believe in boundaries in science. Yeah, you know, it's actually interesting. I have found that I believe in continua rather than at discrete boundary levels, right? And so that if we can apply continua in biology, I think there we can start to describe some of these phenomena better. Hmm. And the problem was, like, in the case of, like, delineating between daily torpor and hibernation, is that they wanted to create strict boundaries.
Yeah.
And what you find is you find that animals sometimes don't read that and they don't subscribe to that.
Okay, well, right? what about the difference between, like, sleepy and sleeping? Do you form a distinction there? Is there a point where you're like, and that thing's sleeping right now? Whereas, like,
And people have tried that with hibernation. So some people have argued that the reason why animals aroused from torpor was so that they could go to sleep, right? Because they were looking at brain waves.
Wait, you wake right? up from hibernation to go to sleep?
I don't believe in it. But these guys were very confident of this. And so they try to do all these experiments where they sleep deprived animals and things along those lines. I see it very differently than that. But so some of the issues are that long ago, people tried to look at brain waves during hibernation. But when you go down, you have such a really low metabolism and a low body temperature. Those waves become so long that they become undetectable. But at the same time, I can take a hibernating ground squirrel at 4 degrees C and I can go and I can shake it and it'll alarm arouse, which means that it had the capacity to sense being shaken and right. things on those lines. So clearly they have nervous system function. So what's the story there?
Yeah. Right? Now, how long's that taken? You wake a squirrel up from
It's really fast. So naturally, they arouse from torpor in about 2.5-3 hours. Hmm. So they go from 4 degrees all the way up to about 36 degrees in just that short period of time. If you alarm arouse them, they can go a little bit faster, but not much faster. But they can start to sort of move around on their own within like about half an hour or so.
Hmm. And going back to the tree squirrel, ground squirrel thing, because a lot of them, like, if I saw one running around on the street, I wouldn't be able to be like, oh, that's a ground squirrel or that's a tree squirrel. Like, a lot of times I probably wouldn't be able to tell.
I can
very readily. You can. But what big differences in terms of it? So if a tree squirrel isn't going and hibernating, does that change the rest of their, like, are they less, because ever since I realized that squirrels burrow, the ground squirrels burrow and often spend so much time hibernating or just kind of in that safety, it made more sense to me that they, when you see them out and about, they're just like seemingly so frantic and like just trying to get the job done and get back to safety. Are tree squirrels' lives like a little more balanced on a whole? Does that make sense? Do you know what I'm trying to get?
Well, ground squirrels are crazy, right? So ground squirrels are really quite interesting in that they can spend 9 months or so in a hibernaculum and have a very short period of time above ground, depending on where they live in. And so the majority of their life is spent in hibernation. And so, you know, I think what you have is this idea of, especially when you're looking at the squirrels, you're looking at modern mammals. You're looking at Boreotherian mammals. And these modern mammals have really high metabolic demands. And so they have to make the most of the limited amount of time that they have. But even, you know, gray squirrels and stuff are kind of crazy too, right? I mean, they're bouncing around off the walls, basically. And so, I don't know.
Hmm. Okay. What would you say is what's the most impressive hibernator out there? I want it defined by, here's two characteristics that I'd be impressed by. One is the length of hibernation, like 9 months. That sounds very impressive to me. And then also how quick can you shut it down? Are there things that can just like arrive, get back, and then just go boom, like no problem. They're just in it.
So again, every animal is a little bit different. So, Fritz Geiser was working with some animals in Australia And he was able to keep them in torpor, in hibernation, where they're arousing. But he was able to keep them there for over 12 months in the laboratory. In the wild, they would never see that, right? Because they have to be able to eat and make a living. So you can go in for a very, very long period of time. The environmental conditions change everything. So we did a study years ago where we put them on to, we built an instrument to measure the heat that was being produced by the animals. And when we did that, we were putting them in with a cooling loop that was taking mineral oil at 4 degrees C. And so it's sort of like hibernating on a cold park bench, if you will. And when we did that, our ground squirrels like quadrupled the amount of time that they spent torpid. They were really torpid for a very, very long period of time. Well, that's probably more akin to what they would see in a wild burrow, right? Is because it's cold and damp and sucking the heat away from them. So I don't know, you know, it's quite interesting. Then you go and you look at our tenrecs, and our tenrecs are the craziest guys because at 28 degrees C, which is fairly nice, it's in the 80s, I believe, right? At 28 degrees C, these guys can go torpid, both in hibernation and in the active season. And so in the active season, they'll be sitting there and their body temperatures vary all over the place and they'll be bouncing around. And then one day, they'll go torpid for a few hours or 5 days. Food is available. They just check out and just go torpid because that's what tenrecs do. And
difference between when you in that case, what's the difference between calling that torpor and
the hibernation
napping?
It's
just a few hours long.
In torpor, their body temperature is basically that of ambient temperature.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. And so there's no deviations from it. They're not moving around. Their metabolism just plummets. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there is definitely a difference.
I see.
But it gets a little bit sketchy as you start to change into other animals, right? As you look at some other animals, defining what torpor is versus what sleep is versus, and this is why I talk about this idea of this being on a continuum.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what about things that kind of get close to that? Like, people that know me know I'm into sloths, for example, kind of my spirit animal. Or koalas, sloths don't sleep. I think sloths are only sleeping like 8 hours or something like that a day in the wild. I think they'll sleep more in a zoo. But and koalas are like famous for sleeping like 21 hours a day or something. Right. But is that, do you know how they're kind of classified?
One of the big sort of misnomers is that when I ask a biologist, hey, what's the body temperature of a mammal? They're going to come back to me and they're going to tell me it's 37 degrees, right? Because we're so used to the Boreotherian mammals. There's like 5,600 and something like that, modern mammals. But when we look at the other groups of mammals, they're really much fewer. So I think there's 39 zonotherins, which include armadillos and things like that. And there's like 89 or 90 Afrotherians, which includes our tenrecs, but also includes like hyraxes and elephant shrews and things like that. And then monotremes, there's only like 5 species. And then marsupials, there's like 380 or 390 species, something like this. So what you have is you have mammals being dominated by these Boreotherian mammals. And that's what really sort of inhabits North America and Europe. So much of what we think about when we think about mammals is because of that bias that we have. And so we think of mammals as having high and stable body temperatures. Mm-hmm. Well, if you get outside of those Boreotherian mammals into these other taxa of mammals, you find that the body temperature is much more variable and it's lower. Mm. And so this idea of this lower and variable body temperature really kind of messes us up in terms of these distinctions that we have in physiological state.
Hmm. So
it all got really complicated. It used to be super easy. And then the more that we learned, then...
Well, have you ever considered stopping learning things? Wouldn't that solve everything? And then you can just have
retirement. Your... Yeah, I've considered retirement a few times.
Yeah. So before retirement, what sort of projects are you working on currently? Like what's the cutting edge? I like the idea of people rushing around a hibernation lab frantically trying to solve all of these mysteries.
So we have a few things going on in the lab right now with Allison Hindel here. We have a big NASA project where we're doing the warm temperature hibernation in ground squirrels, right? And trying to understand what happens in warm temperature hibernation.
I'll shoot you some more ideas for NASA too. Appreciate later that. As they come to
yeah,
me.
Yeah, that'd be good, yeah. And then, you know, on the TENRAC side, we very little was known. And so we've had to do a ton of work. And every day it's something new, right? And it's something crazy. But we've kind of figured out a lot of that stuff, and we just have to clean up a bunch of work. But I think what I'm really excited about now is that in the future, we're going to start looking at sort of what limits body temperature. Why is it only 37? Why isn't it warmer? And try to get at the opposite of hibernation, which I never thought I'd do. So like the TENRAC forced me to sort of rethink the way I see evolution and this idea of endothermy and hibernation.
Yeah, because like flies, you can heat them up. I don't remember this, but I talked to some fly guy like 8 years ago or something like that who would basically heat flies up to see.
So you can heat up mammals really well if they're in torpor, but not if they're active. So you can take a bat and actually get it to become hyperthermic and temperatures that it would never be able to withstand if it was active. But when it's torpid, it's able to withstand that.
Wait, so you can just heat up. Hold on. So you have something that it's in torpor, its body temperature is very low.
There's an anecdotal report of bats. You know, so we have bats in here in the desert, right? Mm-hmm. And people can put up a bat box in their yard. So you think about this bat box in Las Vegas. It's hotter than a bejesus, right? And the sun is just pounding on this bat box. And bats go in there and they go torpid during the day. So what's their body temperature doing? And so there's right. anecdotal reports about body temperatures in bats going into the 120s.
And
they could never handle that if they were active.
That's interesting. I see. So they're doing that in the opposite. Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. But and some of that is sometimes isn't that environmentally triggered as well? Like don't bats often group closer together if there's parasites and stuff around to
we see lots of variation. This is the problem, right? Like biologists came over and they said, hey, I want a rule. Well, it's kind of hard to have a rule for several thousand different species.
Right.
And that's I think the real issue here is that we can't say that there is a rule.
Right. Okay. But it's not the case that you could take something that is sitting there, it's hibernating, it's colder than freezing, and you couldn't heat it up without disturbing it
They'll alarm arouse. So anytime we do big changes in temperature, they alarm arouse. And in fact, the ground squirrels, to get them at minus 2.9, they had to trick them. What they had to do is they had to take them down to 2 degrees C, and then they had to slowly lower the temperature, and they would go down that low. Mm-hmm. If they went too fast, then the animals would defend a body temperature of around 0 degrees C, mm-hmm. and they would never go down that low.
Hmm. Back to the heat, aren't there ideas of speculation that maybe the reason I'm a big nap advocate. I'm amazing at napping. it has to be my greatest life skill. I'm so grateful for it. I can just put it down. I'm so refreshed. There's kind of some ideas that maybe humans in some countries, they have the
biphasic
long,
sleep.
Yeah, with the if we're on the savannah and it's just brutally warm during during the day, might make sense to shut it down for a bit.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's some validity there, and biphasic sleep has been described numerous times in different cultures and things like this. There's a report from like the, I want to say 1880s maybe, in the Lancet, about Russian peasants that were going through a famine. And what they were doing is that they were sleeping for just about the entire time, getting up for a very short period of time, we're talking a couple of hours, and eating a little bit of bread and then going back down again and trying to conserve that way. Who knows?
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
It's kind of hard to say. I mean, what you really need well-controlled studies, and that's kind of hard to do.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a just-so story, I suppose.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to let's see. Yeah, I want to shift gears a little bit because you have something else I'm interested in. I think unrelated bit of research with the pupfish.
Totally unrelated.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So talk about the pupfish, because I had never heard of this thing, which is, I'm sure most of our most of my listeners and viewers have never heard of this thing, as there's not many of the things.
Yeah. So when you think of the desert, you don't really think about fish, but it turns out that we have a decent number of species of fish here. And one of the groups of fish are these things called pupfishes. And Cyprinodon is the genus name, and they're really cool, and they're found throughout Death Valley and the Amargosa Valley. So here's Vegas Valley, Amargosa Valley, then Death Valley. And so these fishes, I happened to get into them in a really weird way. A colleague of mine was working in my lab, and a undergrad said, you know, we should do some work on some live animals. And he said, well, I have these animals. And I was like, well, let's go figure out the oxygen consumption of these animals. And so we started doing the work.
The what? The
oxygen consumption.
Oh, okay.
Just to kind of get at what the metabolic activity is. And the data were crazy. And so we just started doing more and more work. And basically what we found is that when you take these fish, and these fish can live in environments that can be pretty warm. So like, for instance, in the case of Devil's Hole, which is this really bizarre water hole, the water is 33.2 to 33.9 degrees C year round. So if we take the fish and we rear them at 33 degrees, but not at 28, they'll oftentimes enter into what we call paradoxical anaerobism. The longest we've ever seen is 14 hours. So even though oxygen is available, they don't consume any oxygen for 14 hours, and instead they produce ethanol.
And that's what that word meant that you said?
Yeah, we coined the term, paradoxical anaerobism. Okay. So they're using anaerobic metabolism, no oxygen consumption, and it just seems so silly because oxygen was available to them. Turns out that when you're really, really warm, you can't use your mitochondria very well, and you'll have a problem with reactive oxygen species. So we think that they're basically shutting down their mitos and preventing oxygen use in order to avoid this reactive oxygen species production. But instead, what they do is that they produce this ethanol, which is really kind of cool.
How'd these fish get in these holes?
Great story. So Mojave actually means by the water. So when we look out at the Mojave, what we're seeing is the Mojave that we see today.
Yeah, yeah.
Deserts throughout the world are actually really sort of young. So you look at the Sahara, we're talking about 10,000 years. Simpson in Australia is 20,000. Atacama is like 50,000. None of them are really, really all that old. And so the Mojave, we had all of these lakes and streams that were interconnected. Death Valley had 300 meters of water in it 35,000 years ago. 35,000 years ago is nothing, right? And so 10,000 years ago, it was about 100 meters, and 2,000 years ago is still about 10 meters worth of water in it in Death Valley. And so you had this very, very wet environment that sort of dried out. And as a those waters receded, these fish got stuck in the waters that they're stuck in, which happens to be warm springs. So Nevada is just completely inundated with all of these various warm springs.
How many warm springs are there about?
There's a couple hundred. There's quite a few.
Sounds delightful.
Yeah.
To go at night, not during the day. You don't need to be warm. Yeah?
It's still... You know, as long as it's not above 90, then it's okay, right? It's still refreshing.
All right. And fish are just generally pretty common in any one of these?
Tough fish are. So we did a review on the evolution of desert fishes some years ago, and it turns out that there really aren't that many fish that are adapted to live in the desert, but rather what you have is you have tough fish that persist in a desert, right? So... You have, and remember, the deserts are pretty recent. So you had these tough fish that were around. Everything else dies off, and now we see the fish that we see today.
Hmm. Interesting. And so what drew you to pupfish specifically? Why, you just stumbled
basically
on a hole?
Basically, my colleague was there. He said, hey, let's do this work. And I went... Sure, why not? And then it got really quite interesting because, you know, what we find is that you know, like you asked the question, you know, how did the fish get like in Devil's Hole? So Devil's Hole is the coolest water system in the world. It's about a 10-foot wide crack, 3.2 meters by 22 meters, so like 60 feet. And divers have gone down over 400 feet and haven't hit the bottom. And so when there are seismic events around the world, like there is an earthquake over by Oaxaca, Mexico, and this earthquake caused the water to start sloshing around in Devil's Hole, which
really?
Is just a little ways away from Las Vegas, right?
That's cool.
And these fish have probably only been in there for a short period of time. My personal guess would be that some Native American kids grabbed them from the local ponds, dropped them in there. And so we're talking about relatively Wow. recent history. And within people's lifetimes, we've seen some big changes in these fishes already, right? So whales described the species back in 1931. And in 1931, a whole bunch of them had vertebral defects because of the high temperatures. Now you don't see it anymore. And so you know, we oftentimes think about evolution as having stopped yesterday. It's still continuing, right?
Well, especially in a situation like that, there must be new species in every single hole around, right?
So
with
people
the
thought
kind
that.
Of island.
Yeah.
Of-
so people implied this island biogeography idea,
yeah.
especially in the early 1970s. But it turns out that deserts are deserts, and so in the desert it floods, right? I mean, when it rains here, you get these enormous floods that are just absolutely amazing. And so in Ash Meadows, which is my favorite part of Nevada, if you haven't been, you need to go.
I haven't.
And this is where you'll find Devil's Hole. In Ash Meadows, all of the ponds, except for maybe Devil's Hole, will get interconnected in a big flooding event.
Hmm.
Right? And also bear in mind that we get these massive floods every once in a while. So back in the winter of 1861 to 1862, we had what was called an arc storm. It rained for 43 days straight in California, going from basically Oregon all the way into Baja and then into Utah. And it rained so much that there was 9 feet of standing water in the Central Valley, and they had to move the state capital from Sacramento to San Francisco. Anaheim had like a 30-mile embayment of water.
When was this?
1861, 1862.
Wow.
And so we think that maybe these fishes were dispersed during this time frame. But if we look at them in terms of DNA divergence, we'd estimate literally in some cases over a million year divergence time, which tells you that they have this incredibly rapid evolution going on.
I see what you're saying. you're saying a million years worth of evolution by comparison to like your standard
exactly.
species.
Exactly.
Evolutionary.
Right, species. Which makes these really, really interesting fish to look at. I mean, they're fascinating fish.
Well, that's why I don't understand how haven't they diversified a bunch, even just from the 1800s? How haven't they, like?
But they have, right?
Yeah.
And so then people kind of make this claim of, well, you have this island biogeography sort of situation, and each pond would represent a different species. But the problem is if I think of it more as a metapopulation, where every once in a while they get mixed up by a flooding event. And the more severe
that
the meta.
That must be so crazy. I mean, what are the chances of that? So you go out of your, it floods, you go out of your hole, your home, you go for an event. There must be so much fish death at that time of
but the there's always tremendous fish death.
Right.
Right. Suppose, and, yeah. and so that's the problem with fish, right? Is that they're really sort of dependent in terms of the dispersion of where they go. And adventurous fish do better.
They're
right?
making it to another hole, though?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wait, how far away?
So one of my favorite fishes is actually in Cotton Ball Marsh. If you go to Death Valley, there's a place called Salt Creek. And there's a lot of fish in Salt Creek. And but if you went and you went out about 6 or 7 miles straight out into the desert, mm-hmm. you'd find what's called Cotton Ball Marsh. And what it is it's a series of springs, and there's several of them, right? We found one by accident when we went out there that nobody had seen before. And it was like 2 kilometers away from the other ones. But there's a series of springs, and they're about maybe up to 50 meters long, and it might be 20 centimeters deep and maybe about 40 centimeters wide. And that's it. And there's fish in them. And it's called Cotton Ball Marsh because there's so much salt in the water that it creates these big cotton ball puffs of salt sitting around. And fish are living there in Death Valley.
Hmm.
It's hotter than it's crazy how hot it is there, right? Huh. And so these fish are just sitting in there. And you can imagine that every once in a while, one of those populations might get extirpated. Just something comes over, a bird lands, eats all the fish in the little pond.
Done.
It's done. And then they have to wait until the next flooding event before some other fish are populated there.
What are these things eating in a space like that?
Algae.
Oh, okay. All right. What's your pupfish eating?
Algae. Well, in the lab, we feed them goldfish flakes, right?
So. Oh, yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
It works for everything.
Exactly.
Good old goldfish flakes. What do a lot of the fish in these little hot springs, do they often have adorable names or just the pupfish?
Like Jack and Jill or
no, well, pupfish. It's the cutest.
They were called pupfish because people thought it was kind of cute and playful how they were chasing each other around trying to kill each other. Right, it wasn't that cute. The males are incredibly territorial and are trying to beat the bejesus out of each other.
And we're like,
look how cute, yeah.
It's like if an alien saw me fight or something, look at that puppy.
Cute. Yeah,
it thinks it's pretty tough.
Yeah, look at how he got his arms ripped off. But yeah, whatever, right?
All right. So you started with the oxygen. Thing found out that they reject oxygen for first part of life is unusual and interesting. What other work are you doing on the pupfish?
Well, the hibernation story and the tenrex took up so much of our time that
pupfish is by
pupfish
the wayside.
Because
yeah. that's fine. And well, here's the thing.
Now we also have opossums in the lab too. We have genetically modified opossums from Brazil.
Ooh, are they better than ours? Because I go to Australia, I see opossums. Oh yeah. Do we have? Would you say the ugliest possum? The U.S. has to have the ugliest.
Yeah, but interestingly, they live in really cold environments. I don't understand how.
Really? You don't know how are they doing any hibernating of any kind?
Not that we know of.
You think it'd be tough with hanging upside down and everything. But it's like
but there's some crazy stuff. Like I'm supposed to do some work with a friend of mine on on armadillos. Armadillos are now in Nebraska.
Hmm.
In Nebraska. That's crazy, right?
Yeah.
So we're seeing a lot of variation in ranges and a lot of range expansions, probably due to climate change, global climate change.
Right.
And it's kind of cool.
Huh.
If we can understand why and how.
What about like anteaters? Because they're like, they're in the same.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, what's going to happen with the anteaters? Are they going to need to?
Because they're in the same. What is it? Not family, but I forget my tax. They evolved from the same as the armadillo, right?
kind of. Close enough.
Okay, close enough. All right, so you got possums. Well, this is news to me. What possum work are you doing?
So people very recently figured out how to genetically modify opossums. Mm-hmm. And so there's a group in Japan that did amazing work. And so they made a genetically modified animal for us. And we're trying to understand sort of the evolution of thermoregulation with them.
Oh, what did they modify?
I can't tell you.
They gave them more vaginas, didn't they?
No.
Cause they already have like four or something, right? Or two or something like that. Don't they have don't possums have like the split penis thing situation?
Split penis thing and stuff, and it's really confusing.
You can't bring up some mammal with weird genitalia in front of me.
Itinerex have really weird genitalia.
Ooh.
So my Itinerex, their penis is about 70% of body length. And it's prehensile.
Oh, 70%?
70% of body length.
And what was this other word you're using?
Prehensile. So they can roll it up into like a pinwheel and go up one side and then roll it back into the other direction and go up the other side.
I would do that all day
long. And so people ask me, like, you know, why are they so hard to work with? We're really the only group that's ever been able to keep these guys alive. And I tell them the one story about, you know, that they have these really long penises. And we've had at least 10 animals now that have killed themselves because they tied their penis in a knot.
Wow. That's
so there's amazing. Your crazy story for the day right there.
That might be the longest in mammal. Oh, I know like a barnacle has like something exactly. That's like 300 times its body size or something like that. That's fascinating. And then you got females. One hole for that reproduction.
They have
too?
They two have a uterine horns, and so it looks like they're. And of course, the reproduction in Tenrex is crazy. So they have intra-ovarian fertilization that occurs, mm-hmm. right? So usually, what you do is you release the egg and then you fertilize it. In the case of Tenrex, you actually fertilize it in the ovary itself, and then it gets released. Then they also have weird placentas, so we're working with a group trying to understand sort of the evolution of placentas and stuff like this. We find that the Tenrex are super bizarre, and no one's ever been able to keep them, so I'm getting a whole bunch of people asking to collaborate with us. And so lots of people from around the world are coming in to basically do work.
What's the average lifespan?
So
depends.
It really
on, there's
depends
a zillion
on the
different
species
right?
Sounds,
how many different species did you
34.
Say?
34. Okay. So most people,
not a zillion,
if they know
34.
Anything about Tenrex, they know about Echinops telferii, which is the lesser hedgehog Tenrex. And those guys can live for up to 19 years. My guy, I think the record is something like 8 years or something like this. But really at 4 or 5 years of age, they're looking pretty ragged. They're having a hard time. Mm. So they don't live very long. But the problem was keeping them alive in captivity, that people had tried to keep them alive and kept failing. And I have an army of undergrads, some absolutely amazing people who go in there for like 6 hours a day and look after these guys. And that's the only reason why we have them.
Well, you're just monitoring the penis noose situation?
No,
what's
when
so
that
difficult?
Happens, it's pretty much over for us. But what we do a lot of monitoring of their body mass, and we're also extremely meticulous about keeping them clean. So what we found was that if their feet got wet, or if they and they spill their water all the time, or if they stepped in poop or anything like this, they'd have foot problems and things like this. So we keep them ridiculously clean, constantly checking their body condition and intervening and helping them along and changing their diet frequently in order to make sure that we have a good body condition. And it's working. I mean, we're keeping them alive. We're getting more breeding than anybody else has ever gotten. Things are working, but it's a lot of labor. And because there's so much labor, that's the reason why like the Pupfish Project went away. Now I'm trying to expand.
Pupfish are going away anyway, right? We're being honest with ourselves. No. What's the lowest they got there estimated?
36 Diablos in 2013.
I mean.
Now it's in the hundreds. You can go to Shark Reef on Mandalay Bay and you can see some.
So I'll tell you, I have this idea that I noodle with from time to time, and it's more of a premise than anything, but I do these like solo shows. And one of the themes for a show is without giving too much of it away in case I actually make the thing, but it's kind of like about roasting extinction. It's about taking kind of a lot of the things that are on the extinction list and then like kind of being like, but do we really need these things? But in the course of the show, you find out like, actually, it is good to have these things away and doing it.
I've got a great one for you. First species to be delisted was the Tecopa pupfish. And do you know why it was delisted?
Why?
Because somebody built a bathhouse over its pond.
Done.
So if you ever want to know why there needed to be an Endangered Species Act,
yeah,
it's because of that. So there's multiple species in Paramp that of various pool fish, different genus, that went extinct because of the agricultural pumping and ranches and stuff like this. In fact, Ash Meadows, if you went out there now, was a ranch until the 1980s when the Nature Conservancy went and bought it out. And so when they were getting set up to list species for the Endangered Species Act at the very beginning, the Tecopa pupfish was put on it, and then it was the first species that was removed because it went extinct, and it's because they put a bathhouse over the pond that they lived in, over the warm spring that they lived in.
Is it a nice bathhouse?
It's Tecopa. You should go to Tecopa sometime.
See, I mean, so like I'm all for protecting the environment and people give a hard time about the straws. People want their plastic straws. Yeah. They don't care about the turtles. I'm like, well, it's not even just the turtles. You don't understand. The turtles are keeping the sea urchins in check, which will destroy the sea. And then you've just completely got rid of a whole jungle under the ocean and desertification under the ocean. You're missing all this biodiversity. Then your fish population. I'll go on a whole diatribe defending all sorts of species. I hear this pupfish situation. I'm like, I don't know.
But also we have this issue of like sort of almost the arrogance of humans. We're probably the only species who could make a conscious decision to extirpate or save a species, right?
Yeah. It's true. And I'm pro-saving species.
I look at it and I get so angry when I think about like, you know, dodo birds. I want to see a dodo bird.
Yeah.
So why can't I see a dodo bird? Parakeets. You know that there were parakeets all throughout the eastern seaboard. Millions and millions of parakeets. Yeah. And they were extirpated when Europeans came to Americas.
These are great examples to lead with on watch out for human impact thing. I say the pupfish. I need to see
some of them, and then you'll change.
All right.
They're pretty. They're blue.
Okay.
They're cute.
All right.
You should see some.
I'll take your word for it.
You should go to Ash Meadows before you leave Las Vegas.
Yeah, no, I will. I extended my stay. I'll be here for another week. Sounds lovely. I'll ask you for some tips. Well, this has been a terrific conversation. I feel like I had 20 other questions I was going to ask you, but this is a full conversation. I even give you the opportunity to defend pupfish. This is terrific. What do you look forward to in these years before retirement? I only say retirement because you mentioned
it. Honestly, for me, one of the coolest things is actually this project that we're doing with the marsupials, with the opossum. Mm-hmm. In my career, I always thought that the ability to genetically modify an organism and then, you know, sort of investigate mechanistically what's happening was reserved for the people who worked on mice and to a lesser extent, rats. And suddenly this is now available to me. Mm-hmm. And so when do we start doing this at ground squirrels? When do we start doing this? And so the people who are coming in after me, they have so many tools available to them.
Yeah, well, that's why I like to ask the question, because it's just the amount that you're going to be able to investigate. You know,
I have a friend who just got 11 papers in Science last month. And wow. And it's because they had...
It's no Cell Magazine, but it's not too shabby.
Yeah, it's not bad at all. And, but they had... there were 70 sequenced placental mammals. They added another 170 to that mix, right? Wow. Wow. And then they used incredible computing power for 14 months to line them all up. Then, and so now they get to ask questions that we never thought we could ask before. Back up to 37 degrees. That's so cool.
Yeah, it is. It's also that you're doing something classified. That's it's not very often that I ask a scientist.
I don't know. It's classified. We just don't want anyone to scoop us. Like,
oh, you just don't want to be scooped.
Yeah, right.
Don't want them to scoop your body temp regulation. Sure. Out of it. Okay. Sure. Well, we know it's not about genitals. And that's all right. Right. If we were playing 20 questions, I bet I'd get it, but I won't do that to you. All right. Well, thank you so much, Frank Van Brooklyn, for joining me. This is absolutely wonderful. And thank you. Listen, it's wonderful to be back doing the show again. So thank you, listeners, for being such wonderful, curious people. And we'll talk with you next episode.